Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, March 2nd, 2023. Presidio Drag Strip gets initial green light for electronic upgrades by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio. At last Wednesday's meeting, the Presidio Convention and Visitors Bureau, CVB, gave an initial green light to the Presidio Drag Strip for a new light bar and overdue computer upgrades. The funding will also have to be approved by City Council, but the CVB board felt it was a good investment in growing local tourism. Robert Romero and Alex Jimenez of Presidio Drag Racing came to the meeting to make their pitch. They felt the strip was overdue for a new light bar, which signals to the drivers when to start their engines, and a computer that runs the whole system, which has depended on the same software since the first drag races took place in 2013. Romero and Jimenez felt they could attract more out-of-town racing teams with a more sophisticated bug-free setup. The organizers have been diligently working to expand the racetrack itself, but felt the electronic system was a priority. "We got to fix what we have going first," Romero said. The group had originally applied for funding through the Presidio Municipal Development District, but the proposition was never brought to a vote, and an ensuing conflict with former Executive Director Jaron Stevens over the status of the track's liability insurance left the organization's 2022 schedule in question. Presidio Drag Racing ultimately addressed Stevens' concerns and purchased insurance for the event weeks rather than days in advance. With the new system up and running, they're hoping to add even more dates to the calendar this year. "We make a profit, but everything comes out of our pockets up front," Romero explained. Romero and the other drag race organizers are hoping to eventually make the organization a nonprofit, running community events and charity races, and perhaps even funding in-house internships for future mechanics and tradespeople. "We do good things for this community," Jimenez said. This year, they decided to reapply for funding through the Convention and Visitors Bureau, which deliberates on how to spend Presidio's Hotel Occupancy Tax, HOT. HOT runs on the motto, "Heads in Beds," encouraging the growth of the tourism industry by putting money into initiatives that will bring visitors to stay in town and boost the local economy. The drag race organizers felt that by drawing from the HOT pool in advance, they'd be able to make the money back for the city this year and ultimately grow the program's money-making potential. The drag races already bring hundreds of people to town for each event and consistently draw racing teams from Mexico and all over the Southwest. They also felt that Presidians had come to enjoy the event as well and looked forward to each race as a new town tradition. "Every event we have, we get this town rocking and rolling," said Romero. The CVB board ultimately decided to approve the funding to the tune of $16,000. The final authorization to spend the money will have to come from Presidio City Council because it exceeds the CVB's budget. The budget is approved annually, but the HOT fund that fulfills the budget is assessed quarterly and frequently exceeds expectations. Everyone in the room felt that the Presidio Drag Strip was a sure bet, and the organizers were grateful. "It's a big gorilla off my back and a blessing," said Romero. Funding for the Presidio Drag Strip will be discussed and approved at an upcoming City Council meeting, date to be determined. Presidians interested in offering feedback are encouraged to check future agendas online at the City Secretary's website. https://presidiotx.us/PAGE_ID=63. Staff photo by Maisie Crow. Valentine ISD's recently finalized audit of 2021-22 school year finances found roughly $165,000 in unauthorized transactions had taken place. Further investigations are ongoing. Valentine ISD audit reveals $165,000 in unauthorized transactions, prompting further investigations. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Valentine. A recent audit of the Valentine Independent School District found that a lack of oversight over the district's finances resulted in roughly $165,000 in unauthorized transactions, plus instances of falsified documents, prompting an additional forensic audit and a criminal investigation by state and federal authorities. There were numerous instances of unauthorized transactions, improper coding of transactions, altered documents, payments to fictitious employees, and unauthorized withdrawals of the district's funds, reads the financial report, prepared by accounting firm Bollinger, Seegers, Gilbert, and Moss, the district's accountants of several years. These findings are part of a report on material weakness in controls within the document, which concludes that internal controls over financial activities were not properly segregated or monitored, as evidenced by an unnamed sole individual controlling credit cards, bank reconciliations, payroll, recording of transactions, and other financial matters. The audit, covering the 2021-22 school year finances, was presented to the Valentine ISD Board of Trustees last week at a meeting in the schoolhouse. Trustees voted to approve the report, which has now been made public via the Texas Education Agency. The audit reveals $96,960 in unauthorized expenditures within fiscal year 2022, plus $68,075 from prior periods. The combined amount of $165,035, which the report says may be recoverable through insurance, was reclassified to accounts receivable. These adjustments allowed the district to pass a clean audit report free of material misstatements. Because Valentine ISD is a public school district, the $165,000 in unauthorized transactions are taxpayer funds, Engel confirmed. The dollar amounts in unauthorized transactions are preliminary, said Auditor Casey Gast, who presented the findings on behalf of the firm. The results of an additional, more in-depth forensic audit are still pending. That investigation is being conducted by a forensic auditor hired by Underwood Law Firm, the district's legal counsel, said Superintendent Debbie Engel. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Engel said that pending the results of the forensic audit, she was unable to further specify the nature of the unauthorized transactions or how they were logged. In the meantime, said Engel, preliminary findings have been turned over to the Texas Rangers and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. As of press time, no criminal charges stemming from the audit findings had been filed. The FBI declined to provide further information regarding the status of its investigation because it is ongoing. The Texas Rangers did not respond to requests for comment by press time. Engel said that law enforcement agencies may probe district financials from previous years and would likely subpoena the forensic audit findings once complete. Amidst the auditing process, Valentine ISD's longtime director of finance and tax assessor collector, Ernie Villarreal, who had been with the district since 2007 and oversaw its finances during the audited period, chose to step down following a brief suspension. Engel said that Villarreal was first placed on administrative leave in October, shortly after discrepancies were found during the routine audit process the previous month. He then resigned on November 15th, said Engel, and gave no reason for his resignation. When asked why Villarreal had been placed on administrative leave, Engel said it had been a stopgap measure pending the outcome of an investigation into the financial discrepancies. There were some charges that we could not determine and we did not have supporting documentation for, and we were starting an investigation, explained Engel. Villarreal did not respond to requests for comment regarding his resignation. Engel confirmed that the person engaged in the unauthorized transactions referenced in the report is no longer with the district, but would not speak with any greater specificity as the concurrent investigations are pending. The audit also states that personnel changes have been made as a corrective action. In the financial report, auditors recommend the segregation of financial duties that had previously fallen to one individual and the increased involvement of management to help strengthen controls in areas which cannot be segregated, including board oversight. As head of the district, Engel is listed as the responsible party in the report. Engel said the district has, per those recommendations, separated financial duties. The Region 11 Education Service Center has been contracted to assist with payroll and other matters, and an existing district employee has been performing accounts payable duties and tax collections while Villarreal's position remains vacant. We're trying to find out exactly what happened and correct it so it doesn't happen again, said Engel. Due to Valentine ISD's size, Engel said the Director of Finance and Tax Assessor Collector roles have traditionally been combined to create a sustainable job for one individual. In other nearby counties, such as Presidio County, the County Tax Assessor Collector handles school district property tax collections. We were trying to have full-time duties and be able to afford to pay somebody a decent salary to perform those duties, so they combined them, said Engel. The Jeff Davis County Tax Assessor Collector, Sheriff Bill Kitts, and his office temporarily stepped in to assist Valentine ISD this winter after they were left without an in-house tax assessor collector in the wake of Villarreal's resignation, but were unable to help the district long-term. The district will begin its tax season this summer when appraisal values are received by the district, with tax bills going out to property owners in October, said Engel. As far as immediate consequences of the unauthorized expenses go, Engel said it was negatively impacting the small district, which currently enrolls 42 students and adopted a deficit budget this year due to facilities acquisition and salary increases. It's hurting us. It shortchanges the kids, said Engel. It impacts the decisions as to what we do, anything extra we do, any new vehicles we might buy, a bus, playground equipment, trips, activities for the kids. It impacts all of that. This is a developing story. The Big Bend Sentinel will continue to provide updates as they become available. As costly suit against D.A. Ori White continues, a question emerges. Who pays? By Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas. As an ongoing lawsuit against 83rd District Attorney Ori White lingers in appeals court, the question of who foots the bill has been brought to county officials who recently found themselves faced with requests to help cover the top lawyer's legal expenses. White was sued in August 2021 by former Assistant District Attorney Jerry Phillips, who alleged that White had fired him in retaliation for attempting to report improper and possibly illegal conduct within the office. In the suit, which White has characterized as false, Phillips details instances of alleged corruption and cronyism and claims he was wrongfully terminated for attempted whistleblowing. Since August 2022, the suit has sat in the Third Court of Appeals in Austin, where it awaits a ruling on White's appeal that Phillips' suit, contrary to the trial court's ruling, was not timely filed and that it should therefore be tossed altogether. The Texas Whistleblower Act stipulates that claims under the Act must be filed within 90 days of termination. White claims that Phillips missed that deadline, having begun his 90-day count from the day he was removed from payroll and not from the day of his actual termination. In the meantime, expenses stemming from the case have mounted. White hired a private attorney, Stephen C. Kaiser of Midland-based law firm Lynch, Chapel & Alsup, to represent him. Though White would not confirm a figure, two county judges whose courts were approached by White characterized the current cost of legal services as nearing $100,000. According to county officials, White's office has approached the counties that fall within his district, Pecos, Presidio, Jeff Davis, and Brewster counties, to ask that they help cover the cost. White approached Pecos County, the DA's office is headquartered within the county in Fort Stockton, back in November of 2022, requesting that it pay the full amount, roughly $100,000, said Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. But the county had already forked over $40,000 to the cause and couldn't afford to give any more. Judge Schuster explained that the county had been receiving bills for the legal expenses over a period of time and was sending payments to White's legal representation under the impression that the county's insurer would reimburse them. They were shocked to learn from their insurance company, after paying $40,000 in bills, that was not the case. "We were already through the gate and got our foot caught in the gate," said Schuster. "So we'd already spent the money. Instead of making things worse, we just said, we're not paying any more toward your expenses. You need to call the other counties." White's request has appeared on commissioners' court agendas in Presidio, Jeff Davis, and Brewster County courts over the last month. Most recently, on February 14th, the matter was discussed in open session in the Brewster County Court, where County Judge Greg Hennington advocated denying the request. "It's sort of a dilemma, but it's not our dilemma," said Hennington. "So my recommendation to the court is we monitor it, but we are not contributing." The DA's office had made another request, said Hennington, that the office be permitted to take funds already contributed by the county for operating costs, in Brewster County's case, $94,890, and use them instead to cover the legal fees. Hennington recommended denying that request as well. "The money we give them is used for the operations of the district attorney's office," said Hennington. "It's not to be used for anything else." Hennington said the total cost of the legal expenses accrued by the DA's office neared $100,000, and the suit's not finished. In both Presidio and Jeff Davis counties, the matter was discussed in executive session out of the public eye. Jeff Davis County Judge Curtis Evans said he had not received an exact figure from the DA's office, and due to a lack of information, the court opted to take no action. "If the district attorney wishes to revisit the matter," said Evans, "it may appear on a future agenda." Presidio County Judge Joe Portillo said his court had taken the same approach due to a dearth of information. I don't think there's going to be any rush to put it back on the agenda until we get some answers. And the same concerns that Brewster County had, and the same concerns that Pecos County has, said Portillo. Why? How much is it? What are the ramifications? What if another bill comes in? Do we just continue paying this indefinitely? One question begets another. Other county judges had a few more outstanding questions that left them hesitant to take further action. Hennington stated in court that the DA was running up against the problem of accumulated legal fees because he had not been bonded or insured. White declined to address this question. Judge Schuster said he felt the district attorney as a state employee should be represented by the state, not by a private attorney. On this, White agreed. In response to a detailed request for comment, the DA replied by claiming that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton was refusing to represent him, and that it is his belief that the AG's office should ultimately foot the bill for his legal fees pertaining to his appeal. There is a statute in Texas law that requires the Attorney General's office to defend district attorneys in this type of situation. However, for reasons unknown, the Attorney General's office has refused to follow the law, wrote White in an email. When asked to clarify the statute, White did not respond. Texas law does state that the Attorney General is to defend the district attorney in certain instances in federal court. The suit against White is not in a federal court. Another statute states that the Attorney General shall prosecute and defend all actions in which the state is interested before the Supreme Court and courts of appeals. The Attorney General's office did not return requests for comment by press time. There's a recent precedent on the matter in a neighboring district. In September of last year, former El Paso District Attorney Yvonne Rosales, who had retained private legal counsel, appeared before El Paso County Commissioner's Court, arguing the county should pay for her legal defense in a petition to remove her from office. Commissioners voted against providing the funds, but opted to reconsider if the lawsuit against her failed. Rosales has since resigned. At the time, El Paso County Attorney Joanne Bernal told commissioners that while they were not legally obligated to pay for the fees, their decisions should come down to whether doing so would serve a public purpose. Though Rosales requested the matter to be discussed in executive session, Assistant County Attorney Erica Rosales Negaglione advised commissioners that to do so would violate the Texas Open Meetings Act. White said he planned to return to the counties, this time requesting them to appeal to the AG's office. My lawyers have been very patient, and I'm preparing to ask each commissioner's court in the four counties to make a specific request to the Attorney General himself that they step in and represent me. In my opinion, the Attorney General's office should also reimburse what has already been paid to the attorneys for the appeal. A prosecutor with the Attorney General's office has given sworn testimony in the civil suit, stating that some of White's conduct, specifically regarding attempts to take back a case from the AG's office that the previous DA had relinquished due to a potential conflict of interest, prompted concern within the AG's office. The prosecutor, Jeff Barr, had received permission from his supervisor to issue subpoenas and pursue a hearing on the matter, but White halted his attempts to take back the case before the situation escalated.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, March 2, 2023. Comanche Campus to be demolished by Nathan Heuer. Fort Stockton Independent School District's longest-standing campus will soon be demolished following a decision made by the school board on Monday. ISD school board unanimously approved a demolition bid from West Texas Contractors in the amount of $332,750 on February 27th. The school board will use bond funds that were approved in the November 8th, 22 election, and more specifically, a part of the $25 million bond sales that were approved by the board at their January 30th meeting. It was a project that has gone back and forth for quite some time. It was pending, contingent, if the bond came to fruition. It was one of the promises by the board to get rid of the facilities that is a potential hazard and eyesore, said Dr. Zamora. West Texas Contractors' bid was significantly lower than the additional bids that were considered and met the project's requirements. Little John's welding bid was $1.1 million, and Little Regina Trucking came in as high as $1.6 million. The landfill fee dump fee in the bids had the greatest discrepancy, as West Texas Contractors estimated the cost to be $96,000. A representative of Little Regina Trucking spoke at the meeting and addressed the excessive dumping fee costs in the public forum before the bids were considered, stating that materials in the building could contain asbestos and other hazardous materials. The presence is a possibility, although unknown at this time. If indeed there is a presence of harmful materials, the cost to remove and dispose of the harmful materials will be excessive for the contractor. Zamora addressed the concerns, explaining that the contractors will only be required to complete work that was in the request for the proposals. Looking at that, is there a chance there is something under the ground there? Yes, there's something that we have to deal with. It's not the contractor's responsibility to do beyond what the RFP requested. If they encounter asbestos or a meteorite, then it comes back to us to have to get the right people to go through and deal with that. The bid states that the demolition project will be completed by April 15th, 2023. Zamora added that the company will not get penalized so long as they have the project done by June. The campus was constructed in 1952, and according to Assistant Superintendent Gil Ray, Madrid was last active in 2000. City applies for USDA grant by Sean Yorks. Fort Stockton City Council approved resolution which authorizes the city to apply for a grant for assistance under the rules and regulations of rural utility service from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The grant that's being applied for is targeted for the water treatment plant, identified as the water clarifier, said City Manager Frank Rodriguez. Last year we applied for it. We got a letter that we were approved. We're waiting for the secondary use of the funds, which was the beginning of the calendar of this year in January. This is the first step of releasing those funds. The grant was awarded by U.S. Congressman Tony Gonzalez's office. The council approved draw number one, totaling $50,837,000 for work performed by the Bosworth Company on the heating and cooking units of the Fort Stockton Convention Center. This was approved by the EDC board last month. The project total is for $101,675. This is draw number one. They're there. They've got there last week, and they are installing those four units in that open area at the convention center. The city decided to solicit bids for pest control services for city buildings. We did some areas, which are the Chamber Convention Center and the Recreation Building. The Recreation Building, that's school property. So are we going to be spraying on school property now? We just want to make sure we cover those particular areas where our staff is at the weight room, Rodriguez said. In the event that the school does tell me they are, I'll ask to take this up one off. The council recessed into executive session for about 30 minutes to discuss the annual evaluation and renewing the contract of City Manager Frank Rodriguez. When the council reconvened, Ruben Falcon moved to renew the contract with a full positive evaluation for a period of 36 months, and Mayor Pro Tem Casillas seconded the motion. The details of the contract were not made public. The council was supposed to hear a report from Rocky Rivas on the final audit for the fiscal year ending September 30th, 2022. Rivas had not arrived as of 6:30, and the mayor adjourned the meeting. Fort Stockton City Council changes zoning, approves trailer park by Sean Yorks. before Stockton City Council approved an application request from Elena Flores for a specific use permit for a mobile home park in the area adjacent, an area zoned as one family dwelling district. The city also approved a request from L.A. Chris Hagelstein and Patricia Gay Hagelstein requesting a zoning change for property adjacent to 13th Street and Rooney from commercial district to one family dwelling, as well as a specific use permit for a mobile home park. Letters were sent to adjacent property owners surrounding the proposed mobile home park, and the city received no opposition, and there are other mobile homes in the area. Nobody was in attendance at the meeting on Monday night to speak on the item. The owners are moving the Roadrunner Mobile Home Park. They're having issues, City Secretary Nina Cantu said. The Roadrunner Mobile Home Park, they're making a lot of rules and regulations, so a lot of their residents are moving out. They're trying to find places elsewhere. These are different property owners who have found it in their best interest, and they're wanting to do rent-to-own. In speaking to Puha, the city attorney, that was the cleanest way to allow for this to happen, so they can come in and renting it, and they'll still own it. The council approved the ordinance and amending the zoning at 13th and Williams and 13th and Rooney to allow for the park.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, February 23rd. Twin sisters arrested after video surfaces of assault. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans police officers arrested twin sisters on February 16th for an alleged assault on a couple which happened on January 17th. Officers arrested 20-year-old Adriana and Amanda Baltazar of 4110 South Boston and 3500 South Arizona, respectively, twin sisters who were identified as the culprits after officers were given a video recording of the assault by an individual who wanted to remain anonymous. Officers were called to 502 East A Street around 8:45 a.m. in reference to an assault. Quote, when officers arrived, they spoke to the victim, Sherilyn Chavira, age 18, and boyfriend, Xavier Juarez, age 19, who said the Baltazar twins knocked on the door, and when Chavira opened the door, the twins began assaulting her, Monahans Police Department Captain Stormy Law said. While coming to Chavira's rescue, Juarez was also attacked, and one of the victims was struck with a large stick, Law said. The twins fled the scene after the attack and were gone from the scene by the time officers were called. Laws added, the suspects were known to the victims, but it wasn't clear what led to the assault. Officers were given a video of the assault by an anonymous source, and based on the victims' identifications and video surveillance, an arrest warrant was issued for the Baltazar twins, and they were both subsequently arrested and taken to Ward County Jail. Adriana Baltazar was charged with assault caused bodily injury, a Class A misdemeanor, and Amanda Baltazar was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a first-degree felony. Quote, Amanda's charge was aggravated assault because the video showed she was the one hitting the victims with a stick, Law said. Adriana's bond was set at $5,000, while Amanda's bond was $20,000. Both girls posted the bond and were released. Father attacks son with hammer, son shoots dad with BB gun. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A father was in custody while his son was recovering from being hit with a hammer during an argument last Saturday. Monahans Police Department officers arrested 57-year-old Roger Ray McGuire of 102 North Franklin after responding to the incident around 1:55 p.m. Quote, once officers arrived, they spoke to the victim, Michael McGuire, age 33, who told officers he and his father were in an argument, and while the two were exchanging words, Roger left the room and returned with a claw hammer, Monahans Police Department Captain Stormy Laws said. The elder McGuire struck his son in the back of the head with a hammer, and in order to stop the attack, Michael shot his father with a plastic BB gun, Laws added. Roger was still inside the home when officers arrived, and he told officers his son shot him with the plastic BB gun first. Quote, "The victim's wounds were consistent with being hit with a hammer, therefore Roger was subsequently placed under arrest and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a first-degree felony," he said. McGuire's bond was set at $25,000. He remains in custody in lieu of posting the bond. The offense carries a penalty of 5 to 99 years or life in prison, and or a fine up to $10,000. Students learn about career choices and living on a budget. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. A job fair and It's Your Money, Financial Education for Young Adults, formerly known as Welcome to the Real World program for Monahan's Wicked Piute High School students, was held at the Ward County Event Center last Wednesday. The event was a collaboration of local people, organizations, businesses, and military who had booths set up to educate and expose young adults to the realities of daily living and many different work opportunity careers available after high school graduation. Freshmen, sophomores, and juniors were bused out to the event center and spent approximately an hour each learning about budgets and job earnings, while the senior class spent an hour and a half at the event. Quote, "The seniors are closer to this becoming their life. They will be out there in the real world in a few months. Learning this now may save them from getting into bad financial trouble when they are out there on their own," Career and Technical Education Director at Monahan's High School, Scott Burkett, said. The program consists of two parts, financial education and real-world expenditures decision-making opportunities. Students will complete lessons on basic financial topics, including financial well-being, invest in ourselves, tracking and budgeting, and using financial services in the real world. Each lesson is designed to teach new concepts related to personal finance and allows the students to begin to create their own financial plans. In the simulation of the real world, it is assumed that the individual has completed basic educational requirements for their chosen career field, and they are a 25-year-old single adult. Then the students receive salary information correlating to the job field they have chosen. After deducting income-related taxes, they determine how much of their simulated net salary they wish to save, while the remaining goes to support the cost of living expenses. The students then proceed to learn about various living conditions, situations, choices, and the seeing on paper the cost of 12 or more everyday living categories. For housing, the participants choose from a selection of options such as renting versus purchasing, house versus apartment, and insurance needs based on their housing choice. The next real-world decision is transportation. What option will fit their needs? New or used auto or truck, sports car, mid-size sedan, truck, sport utility vehicle, or hybrid vehicle, as well as the cost of insurance, gasoline, oil changes, etc. Real-world insurance costs are on the educational agenda in the form of health insurance, auto insurance, and optional life insurance. Monthly utilities are based on the type of housing that was chosen, but includes lights, water, gas, and cable, internet, and cell phone plans. Next is groceries selected to fit their personal preferences and purchased only at the grocery store and prepared at home. Clothing is another cost of living they explore based on personal choice, along with set costs for laundry and dry cleaning. If they have or want a pet, the cost of owning a pet is part of the budget and is based on the size or kind of pet. This includes food, health care, grooming needs, boarding cost, or travel cost if traveling with the owner. Credit card management is explored by some of the participants. Parenthood, to be or not to be, has to be considered. The cost of parenthood is based on child care, health care, food, and miscellaneous items for one child under the age of 2 years old. Entertainment is up next for consideration. Many entertainment choices are offered: concerts, eating out, sports events, movies, etc. Participants have the opportunity to give either a monetary donation to a charity of their choice or to donate their time. The participating students will spin the reality wheel to learn how life throws a curveball when least expected, such as, you received a speeding ticket and need to pay $175, or you had a garage sale and earned $250. When all these stations have been visited and recorded, the students see whether they had enough money from their simulated job career or if they ran out of money. Quote, I barely had enough money to meet my expenses, is an often heard comment when the financial education for young adults simulation is finished. If the student had a negative balance, they reconsider some of the choices they made and discuss the alternatives they need to not overdraw their account. They learn to balance expenses for their income by making wiser consumer lifestyle choices, reducing spending, developing a realistic spending plan, and encouraging them to think about selecting a different occupation that has a higher income or getting more education and training to improve earning potential. The Job Fair Career Day was implemented by Monahans High School teacher Heather Pittman, who teaches general employment, physical education, and career prep classes last year on a smaller scale. Quote, when we moved here in 2021, I was planning on being a stay-at-home mom to our four kids, but when I was enrolling my high schooler, I asked about qualifications for being a substitute teacher. High school principal Daniel Sharp told me with my qualifications, I needed to fill out an application for a teaching position, which I was hired for. I saw a need for my students to be exposed to actual job opportunities and arranged the small job fair last year and received good feedback from the students. At the beginning of the school year, I started planning for another job fair to be held in the spring. I had no idea it would become such a huge success. I started out contacting some of our local businesses. Not only would they say yes to participating, but would they suggest another business they knew of who would be interested in participating? It was a domino effect. Each one led to another. I have great big thank yous for so many people who helped make this come together: Monahans High School Career Technology Director Scott Burkett, Haley Lacaz, Family Community Health Extension Agent, Monahans Chamber of Commerce Director Teresa Burnett, Brooks Landgraf, Todd Hunt, Keisha Rasmond, the Billy Riley Family, Carla Davis, Child Protective Services, as well as many teachers, counselors, and administrators. It was an amazing event that really did help show students some of the possibilities of going forward with life after school, Pittman said. Approximately 60 job booths were set up for the students to ask questions about salary, job training, qualifications, and or college required for the positions. Some of the job booth career choices included the medical field, emergency medical services, financial, military, photography, retail sales, various oil field jobs, education field, law enforcement. Diamondback Energy of Midland set up mock interviews with 16 of the students to give them a more complete experience of job hunting procedures. Quote, I have already gotten feedback from the students about adding even more career fields to next year's list. They have expressed interest in having representatives from the fields of auto tech and diesel mechanics, cosmetology, and lawyers be represented for career exploration, Pittman said. Monahan's high school athletes recognized for advancing past district. The story was written by Jan Crenfield. The Monahan's Wicket Pyote ISD Board of Trustees met Monday, February 20th, in the boardroom at the administration building for a regularly scheduled meeting. The meeting was called to order by MWP ISD Board of Trustee President Raymond Reyes. A quorum was established and the invocation was given. Visitors were recognized and public comment was invited. No one attending had any public comment. The swim team was presented to the board members by MWP ISD Superintendent Chad Smith in honor of their trip to compete in the Texas State High School Swim Competition held February 9th and 10th at the Josh Davis Natatorium in San Antonio. 19 MHS swimmers traveled to San Antonio for the competition. 11 swimmers competed with 8 alternates as backup. Coach Jay Thomas had each swimmer introduce themselves and tell the school board what event they qualified for. Being recognized next was the MHS girls basketball team for advancing to the bi-district championship playoff game. In regular business, the superintendent's report covered the parent report card day on Wednesday, explaining times parents could pick up their students' report card. Also in the superintendent's report was information pertaining to the dates of the Texas Association of School Boards Summer Leadership Institute. The dates will be San Antonio, June 14th through 17th, or Fort Worth, June 21st through 24th. Texas school board members are required to attend leadership classes. The enrollment report for February reflected 2,193 students enrolled and shows a slight enrollment increase over January's 2,183 for district totals. Minutes from the last regular meeting and special meetings of January 16th were approved by the board. The next order of regular business was the financial report presented by Katie Jones, MWP ISD business manager. Jones reported the district has, as of January, a general operating fund showing $3,500,000 cash in the bank, investments for $49,685,000, totaling $53,187,000 available general operating funds. Jones also reported on the bond proceeds and expenditures through January. Bond expenditures were construction cost totaling $95,177,000, architect fees for $9,200,000, professional services at $16,900, asbestos management came to $157,000, legal services totaled $8,400, miscellaneous contracted service for $429,000, supplies for the amount of $5,330,000, bond planning totaled $39,145, bringing the final total of bond expenditures to $110,376,000. Next on the agenda was presenting a policy update on the Local 120 policy. Quote, the updated codes for our local school policy cover an update concerning district policies on bullying, stating school policies must address prevention and mediation of bullying incidents, which our district already has in place as policy. Another updated policy concerns circumstances where restraint may be called for in extreme situations, but we are one step ahead in this area too. District personnel are given a training class called Handle with Care, in which they are given hands-on training on restraining a student without harming the individual, MWP ISD Superintendent Chad Smith said. In other regular business, the budget amendments were approved, and the board moved to closed session to address employee hiring and employee resignations, of which there were none. The board returned to open session to give approval to the contract considerations for assistant superintendents, directors, principals, non-Chapter 21 business manager, and curriculum tech coordinator. The next regularly scheduled MWP ISD school board meeting is for March 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Administration Building Boardroom, 606 South Betty. Any individual who has a concern or question can request to be placed on the board meeting agenda. Anyone interested in addressing the Board of Trustees needs to pick up a registration form from the administration office. Individuals may only address issues which are listed on the agenda, which is posted 72 hours before the meeting day. They must be registered to speak by 12 noon on the day of the meeting and will have 4 minutes to speak. The public is encouraged to become involved in affairs concerning the students. New surgeon joins WMH. When it comes to general surgery, there is a new option in the region. Ward Memorial Hospital announces the addition of Dr. Samuel Harden, a board-certified general surgeon, to the local medical community. Quote, "The availability of comprehensive healthcare programs and services locally is essential," explains Leticia Rodriguez, CEO of Ward Memorial Hospital. "We are thrilled to have Dr. Harden in Monahans to provide his surgical expertise and complement Dr. Day to help patients in our community," end quote. General surgeons have the expertise to diagnose a range of diseases, disorders, and conditions and utilize minimally invasive surgical techniques and endoscopies to treat patients. Additionally, a general surgeon can also perform diagnostic tests to guide the need for surgery. Dr. Harden works with patients with various needs to perform procedures in a minimally invasive manner. He performs a full gamut of general surgical procedures such as colonoscopy, hiatal hernia repair, carpal tunnel release, hysterectomy, bone and joint repair, and much more. His practice has included reconstructive vascular surgery, and he is certified in advanced wound care and hyperbaric medicine. A Mobile, Alabama native, Dr. Harden completed his undergraduate medical education at the University of South Alabama College of Medicine in Mobile. He then completed his postgraduate internship and residency at the Kind Drew Medical Center program in Los Angeles County, California, which included extensive training in vascular, pediatric, and trauma surgery at various facilities in the greater Los Angeles region. As an avid educator and writer, both on professional and avocational themes, Dr. Harden enjoys surgical and medicine education immensely and has served as a mentor for young surgeons. He has long been an instructor in advanced trauma life support courses in cities as varied as Birmingham, Alabama, Washington, D.C., and Lubbock, Texas. Dr. Harden is certified by the American Board of Surgery and is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, among other industry associations. Quote, "Monahans in the greater Ward County region is seeing great growth," Dr. Harden says. "With a diverse and ever-changing community landscape, I know that I can make a difference in improving the lives of many residents in the area," end quote. For more information about local surgical capabilities at Ward Memorial Hospital, or to schedule a consultation with Dr. Harden, please call 432-943-5885. New youth pastor settles in at FBC. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The First Baptist Church Youth Ministry in Monahans has a new man at the helm. Blaine Bernstein has settled into his new role as Associate Pastor of Students in October 2022. Although he is new to the church and to Monahans, Bernstein is no stranger to student ministries. Quote, "Overall, I spent about 30 years working with students," he said. Blaine grew up in the church, and his father was a pastor for many years in places such as Morgan Hill, Tye, Slayton, and Fort Worth. Quote, "I am originally from Iowa Park, but we left there when I was in second grade. We moved to Fort Worth in my junior year of high school, and I graduated from North Richland Hills in 1994. Blaine said he felt God's calling into the ministry the summer before his senior year of high school at camp. After high school, he attended Tarrant Junior College for a short time, but left to take a job as a youth pastor in Rome. Blaine earned his degree from Northwestern Christian University in Florida. Blaine said he was inspired to work with youth because of how he was raised. Quote, "I had an incredibly great family and was extremely blessed growing up. I don't know why, because I'm not any different than anyone else, but I know not every kid was afforded the same opportunities as I was, and I don't want to waste it. I want to share it," end quote. Blaine explained, quote, "Teenagers have so much going on in their lives, and for some, their home lives are rough. So my goal is first and foremost, I want them to know Jesus as their Savior, and also I want the kids to know we care about them, their lives, what happens to them, and that they matter," end quote. Blaine and his wife Misty have four children, and they have recently purchased a home in town. Before coming to Monahans, Blaine and his family spent 8 years at a church in Toller, but felt a change was needed. Quote, "We began to pray about our situation, then eventually my wife was offered a teaching job in Odessa," he said. 2 weeks after Misty got the teaching job, she saw the position for a youth pastor at FBC Monahans. God opened the door, and the Bernsteins are now serving at FBC Monahans. Quote, "We're loving it here in Monahans, not just the church and people here, but the town and community in general," he said. Quote, Blaine says he looks at ministry like a coach coming into a new program. "It's like a rebuilding phase, and my goal is to fill up the student ministry with kids. We want them to know FBC is a safe, fun, relaxing, and good atmosphere where they will be accepted no matter what. They don't have to know everything about the Bible or God to attend," end quote. FBC youth meet twice a week. On Sundays, they have Bible study in the loft at 9:30 a.m. and worship in the sanctuary at 10 a.m. On Wednesdays, they meet in the fellowship hall for a church meal at 5:30. They head upstairs to the loft for worship and Bible study at 6:15 p.m. The church will offer a 3-day weekend retreat called D-Now at the end of March. Junior high and high school students, grades 7 through 12, are welcome to attend. Call Blaine at the church office, 943-4301, for more details.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.